Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On April 1st, 2021, the Supreme Court decided Florida versus Georgia, an ongoing case of original jurisdiction involving Florida's desire to limit the amount of water that Georgia uses in the Apalachicola-Chattahoochee-Flint River Basin. Justice Barrett, writing for the 9-0 majority, dismissed the case, holding that Florida failed to establish that Georgia's overconsumption of interstate waters was either a substantial factor contributing to or the sole cause of Florida's injuries. Tony Francois, senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, joins us today to discuss the court's decision in this case.
So this is Florida versus Georgia on April 1st of this year. So 12 days ago, the Supreme Court published its decision in this water use dispute in which Florida sued Georgia in what is called an original action in the Supreme Court. Article 3, Section 2, Paragraph 2 of the United States Constitution gives the Supreme Court original jurisdiction over cases, quote, in which a state shall be a party, close quote. And a significant number, if I had to guess, I'd hazard that it's a majority of the state versus state original actions in the Supreme Court involve these kinds of interstate water disputes. The Supreme Court previously decided one of these cases earlier this term in Texas versus New Mexico, and the Federalist Society's Courthouse Steps podcast on that decision is currently available on the Federalist Society's website. Compared to Texas versus New Mexico, the facts and legal issues in Florida versus Georgia are pretty simple. The dispute is over Georgia's use of water from two rivers that arise in Georgia, the Chattahoochee and the Flint, which flow through Georgia into Lake Seminole, which sits in Georgia and on the boundary between Georgia and Florida. Lake Seminole then feeds the Apalachicola River, which flows through the Florida Panhandle into the Gulf of Mexico in the general vicinity of Panama City on the Florida Panhandle. The Georgia water uses at issue in the case include municipal supply for the city of Atlanta, and that's from the Chattahoochee, and farm irrigation from the Flint River in southwestern Georgia. On the Florida end of the system, that state is concerned about an oyster fishery in Apalachicola Bay, which has badly declined in recent years. Florida blames this decline on excessive use of the basin's river in Georgia, which Florida argues has reduced freshwater outflows to the oyster beds, which in turn has allowed salinity to increase in those waters, resulting in harm to that fishery. Florida filed the case against its neighbor to the north in 2013, arguing that Georgia's water use is unreasonable and asking the Supreme Court to equitably apportion the basin's waters between the states. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case under its original jurisdiction power and assigned it to a special master for fact-finding and recommendations, which is the customary way these cases proceed. 8 years later, the case is resolved in Georgia's favor. No liability for upstream diversions from the rivers in Georgia, at least so far as harm to Florida's oyster fishery is concerned, and thus no equitable apportionment of the basin between the states. The decision, published on April 1st, is in many ways as simple as those facts. It's unanimous. It runs all of 10 pages. It affirms in its entirety the fact-finding and recommendations of the special master who conducted the trial in the case and states that Florida first was required to show by clear and convincing evidence that Georgia water use was at least a substantial cause of the decline in Florida's oyster fishery. And then two, that Florida failed to meet that burden and therefore was not entitled to apportionment as a remedy. And based on this, the court adopted the special master's recommendation to dismiss the case. So pretty straightforward. And one of the unusual things about these original action cases is that generally they turn on factual questions, sometimes, you know, some legal questions, but frequently those legal questions are very particular to the two states at issue or a prior court decree governing division of waters between the states. So these are kind of the rare Supreme Court decisions that deal with, you know, disputed facts. And, you know, those who are familiar with Supreme Court practice are, you know, will spot immediately. You know, it's a pretty rare thing for the Supreme Court to be, you know, deciding whose experts have the better of a contested factual question. So that's one of the things that's a bit different about the cases that arise in the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction. There are also a couple of interesting things that happen along the way when one looks a little more closely at how the court resolved this case. So Atlanta is 350 miles from the Florida Gulf Coast, and naturally a case arguing that the use of water, you know, for golf courses and the like in Atlanta is harming oyster beds that far away in another state. Those claims are going to involve obviously complex expert opinion testimony and conflicting expert opinion testimony. The opinion by Justice Barrett starts by acknowledging this. The special master to whom the court referred the case held a 5-week trial. It was dominated mostly by expert testimony on both sides. And Justice Barrett kind of previews or prefaces her discussion of the case with this, you know, very blunt statement. Quote, "Of course, the precise causes of the bay's oyster collapse remain the subject of ongoing scientific debate. As judges, we lack the expertise to settle that debate and do not purport to do so here. Our more limited task is to evaluate the party's arguments in light of the record evidence and Florida's heavy burden of proof," close quote. So short version, you know, we're judges, not scientists, you know, don't look to us to, you know, resolve complex scientific questions. The thing is, the decision's remaining pages are a close evaluation of what the various expert witnesses testified to and against before the special master on both sides of the argument, followed by simply a resolution, you might even call it a settling, of the debate between those experts. So there's some tension between the caveat, we lack expertise to address scientific questions, and the very next act, which is the perfectly normal judicial function of adjudicating the facts of cases which involve conflicting evidence, including conflicting opinion testimony, under applicable legal formula and burdens of proof. And even in doing that, the court had little trouble surveying the expert opinion evidence, from which the special master concluded and the court agreed that it was clear that a variety of confluent factors in the decline of Florida's oyster beds, including things like long-term drought conditions, controversial water management operations carried out by the United States Army's Corps of Engineers, and both significant overharvesting by Florida oystermen, and inadequate steps to reestablish depleted oyster bars. So among these causes, even Florida's expert evidence limited the contribution of Georgia diversions from the basin to a very insignificant impact on oyster production. And from all of this, the court pretty easily concluded that, as a factual question, Florida was unable to demonstrate that any diversions, let alone excessive diversions in Georgia, had contributed enough to the problems in the oyster beds to entitle Florida to a remedy. So why the apparent punt on scientific expertise immediately before surveying the scientific evidence and resolving the case based on that scientific evidence? Well, it might simply be a reminder that court cases which address scientific questions do so in a specific way, and that way relies on the existing rules of admissibility of evidence, the adversary system, and burdens of proof. And perforce, when you present a scientific question or a technical question in that way in a case in court, some of it you present and other aspects of it you don't present. And the way you present it is not the iterative method of what we all recognize as the scientific method. And so sometimes, probably quite wisely, judges find it important to remind their readership that different paradigms for analyzing a scientific question could easily yield different conclusions about that question, and that one court's resolution of a particular scientific question is not even really the last word in that particular question. Court's readership, especially the Supreme Court's readership, their audience, is still primarily lower court judges and the bar. But, more and more people take an interest in the Supreme Court these days, and it's probably wise for the court to be, signaling to the broader reading public and to its political audiences that, by saying this side wins this case on this scientific issue, we're not purporting to answer for all time what the answer to that scientific question is. So you can think, for example, of some of the recent jury verdicts in federal court against pesticide manufacturers, finding those manufacturers liable for causing cancer, that the product causes cancer. It's important to distinguish between the outcome of a case like that, in which a particular jury finds that the answer to that question is yes. That is not dispositive for all time of whether that product actually does cause cancer. And it's a reality of our litigation system that, from time to time, different juries will answer that question in completely opposite ways. And when you think about some of the technical questions that federal courts increasingly face, climate policy is probably the big one. Do our cars and power plants, are they changing the climate? And is that a good, bad, or indifferent thing? It's probably wise to remind the bar and the public that deciding cases and controversies through the due process methods of the adversarial system and the rules of evidence is not the same thing as the scientific method and should not be thought of in the same vein. But even in light of this observation, this qualification on what courts do, there's a remarkable thing sitting in plain view in the Florida versus Georgia decision. Among the various bits of expert opinion evidence in the case are three government reports. On Florida's side, there are two items: a report by a Florida state agency assigning blame for the oyster failure to Georgia's water use, and then a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, report from the federal government adopting Florida's view on that same question. So you have a state and federal agency publishing their technical opinions, basically, on liability. And these were actually very important elements of Florida's case. And yet, the Supreme Court brushed them aside without much difficulty as not satisfying Florida's burden of proof. On the other side of the case, the court credited a report from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service stating that the condition of a particular species in the Florida end of the basin, a species of fish, I want to say, that particular species was steady to improving under the water conditions that Florida was complaining about. It's worth stepping back and thinking about these three reports for a moment in the context of this case and other types of cases. So picture, instead of this being an original action between two states, or just more generically, any civil action which proceeds by the rules of civil procedure, discovery, and trial of facts, imagine instead of this dispute had emerged in a different context, say a federal agency action by NOAA Fisheries or the Corps of Engineers, directing reduced diversions in Georgia under whatever statutory and regulatory power that agency holds. If the exact same question arose in that context, in that procedural posture, it seems almost certain that the outcome would have been the exact opposite. That is to say, if instead of Florida suing Georgia in essentially, you know, a civil trial, if Georgia were challenging a federal agency action reducing its water use that was taken in order to protect downstream natural resources within that agency's charge, the NOAA opinion on that subject would almost certainly be dispositive in that litigation. Federal courts would have deferred to the federal agency's fact-finding and expertise and allowed the agency to do what it thought best in almost all almost every time that case is litigated. Nor would the possible contrary opinion of a different federal agency be given much weight by the courts. And, you know, most tellingly, no amount of record evidence proffered by Georgia would ever be enough to overcome the very low substantial evidence standard that the federal agency would have to meet for its decision to be affirmed, essentially to force the federal courts to defer to its decision. So while on the surface this is a pretty simple case, it does serve as a window into two very different ways that federal courts look at complex technical questions and how important it is for the outcome what type of case the technical question arises in. If it's what you might call a normal lawsuit governed by the rules of civil procedure leading to a trial of facts, government agency opinion may carry no more weight than any other expert opinion. It might prevail or it might not. It's not entitled to special weight in that regard. But if the action is a challenge under the Administrative Procedure Act to a final agency action based on the exact same agency opinion, almost nothing carries more weight than that agency opinion. And that, at least to this observer, I'll wrap up by saying, is a strange distinction on which to base a court's resolution of a factual dispute.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.